This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. For tens of thousands of people in Harlem during the Great Depression, George Baker was Father Divine, and Father Divine was God. Today, for 18 people in Gladwin, Pennsylvania, he still is. And although Baker died in 1965, for his followers, he is still very much alive. Photographer Kristen Bedford spent 5 weeks living in a community with some of the followers of Father Divine. She learned more about the group and took pictures. Kristen has created an exhibit called The Presence of Father Divine, and you can see it from March 18th through the 30th at the Carrick Modern Art in Durham. And there are a few of her photos at our website, stateofthings.org, if you want to take a look while we're talking or at any time. Kristen, welcome to the program. Good to have you here.
Thanks for having me, Frank.
Tell us more about Father Divine and the origins of the worship of Father Divine.
Well, he came to prominence in 1930s Harlem, and as you mentioned, he had tens of thousands of followers and supposedly hundreds of thousands of sympathizers. And in the early 40s, he moved his headquarters to Philadelphia, and that's where he married Mother Divine in the second body, and she was 21 years old. And that's key to my story because after he died in 1965, she was still a relatively young woman and was able to lead the group. And she's now 88. And I think it's in part, you know, her longevity that the group has stayed around as long as it has.
And was there a Mother Divine in the first body?
Yeah, Pinaya. She was African American. She was a bit older than Father Divine. And then she had said that she always wanted to come back in a younger, healthier body. She had some health issues. And then when Mother Divine in the second body declared that she was Mother Divine in the second body, they introduced reincarnation.
What did happen to the first Mother Divine?
It was a mystery. Nobody knows.
Nobody knows. So give us the message. What is Father Divine's message?
Well, Father Divine is God. This is really the crux that you have to understand. He's not a prophet. He's not a messiah. He is God in a human form. And he believes that integration is God's will. So and so they don't say white or African American. They say light complected and dark complected because all people come from the same lineage.
Ben, what do we know about George Baker? How did he come to be Father Divine?
He obscured his past pretty well. Jill Watts did a lot of work in the census, and she found that he was born in Rockville in 1879. And then he moved to Baltimore later and learned about various forms of preaching styles and was introduced to somebody who said they were a god. And then he, in about 1912, according to Jill Watts, you know, took on that same way of speaking. And I'm not an academic, so we just need to preface that. I've read as much as I could, but I am a photographer.
Right.
So
here's this guy, George Baker, somewhere around 1912. Mm-hmm. We don't know much about him, but at some point he declares he's God. This is 1912. Mm-hmm. How is he doing, you know, between 1912 and the Depression? And then what do you think happened that allowed for him to gain tens of thousands of followers?
So he, from what I've read, he started his tour of the South after he declared his divine status and picked up followers here and there. And that's where he met Pinaya. And that's also where they established the foundation of what they call the Modesty Code, which is the vow to celibacy and no drinking and obscenity. And eventually they bought a house in Sayville, Long Island, and where they formulated and sort of officiated this concept of the communion banquet, which is their official ceremony. It's their church service. It's a long meal that they have. And due to a number of legal reasons and space reasons, they needed more room to grow. That's when he moved to Harlem in 1932 and really just it exploded. I mean, it was the Great Depression and people were longing for all sorts of things, and he was one vehicle.
So how did it work? Tens of thousands of people, they obviously all didn't live in the same place. Did many of them? What was there kind of any sort of communal living?
Yeah, they owned many properties. All of the deeds were in the followers' names, though. Yeah. And so the where I stayed in Gladwin, Pennsylvania, at their Woodmont estate, is not in Mother or Father Divine's name. It's in, you know, probably in some of the followers' names as well. And it's a 70-acre estate that I lived on while I took pictures for 5 weeks.
All right. So tell us about life in Gladwin then.
Well, in order to be there, I had to adhere to their codes of conduct. So I had to change the way I dressed and be fully covered. I had to minimize conversation with the opposite sex. That's definitely
is celibacy
frowned on. Celibacy is still a large part of it. And of course, I, you know, constantly I'm like, hey, how are you doing? You know, and no, you had to rein that in. I think the biggest challenge for me in living in Gladwin, and they were absolutely lovely people and very generous, very kind. I mean, that just has to be stated without a doubt. But the biggest challenge for me was this spoken word, because they don't say hello. It's actually banned because it has the word hell in it. And so all salutations are replaced with peace. But I think even harder for me to adapt to is the sentence structure, and that they take out all of the ego. So if I was to say, Frank, I love your show. You and your staff do a really great job. Thank you so much. If you were a follower of the movement, your sole response would be, thank you, Father, Mother, for the state of things. You would be taking you, your staff, my experience, me, you know, everything out of it and turning it into the divine. And we don't realize how much we talk about ourselves. And while I was there to change the construct of how I related to them was really important to respect their value system.
So this is a society that is not ego-driven, believes in integration and harmony, and greets you with peace. So far, so good. We can quibble over the divinity part of it, but it does sound like, in terms of the essential message, and of course celibacy speaks to perhaps the longevity of the group if they don't keep attracting followers. How did you find out about this group, and what attracted you to them?
So as an undergraduate studying American religious traditions at George Washington University, I read a book by the anthropologist and civil rights activist Arthur Huff Fawcett, and it's called Black Gods of the Metropolis, Negro Cults of the Urban North. And it was published in 1944, and what he did was look at five non-traditional Black-founded religious groups in the Philadelphia area. And he treated them with the respect and observation that you would for any mainstream religious group, which is pretty radical because the world considered these groups cults. And so I read this book, and I was really struck by his approach, and it really spoke to my interest in that looking at people photographically is about relationships. And so I went this summer to Philadelphia and to find those five groups that he wrote about. And I actually found all five of them. And Father Divine's followers was one of them. And so it's just really interesting that exactly 70 years later, because it's, you know, published in 1944, that I'm applying this photographic approach that he was applying to his scholarly work.
I want to hear more about that and sort of how you approached this and how you were received. I do need to get a little bit more of the history to understand this. Tens of thousands of followers. What was the reporting on this group at the time? And what accounts for the remarkable kind of the explosion and attraction of that faith? Again, now we're talking about the Depression and in Harlem. What did people at the time say accounted for it? What have people said since?
I mean, I think it's fair to say that Father Divine has sold a lot of newspapers. Mm-hmm. Hearst definitely used him to the max. I think that people have spun him as a charlatan, as, you know, one of the first modern day cult leaders. I think, though, in the 30s, a lot of newspapers acknowledged that he was providing for vast amounts of people these large banquets. And the New Yorker actually did a three-part segment, I think in the 40s, that was pretty remarkable and thorough. And, you know, it's definitely its biases. But for the most part, he's been spun as as somebody, as a charlatan.
Often with cults, we hear of terrible scandals, sometimes violence and other sorts. But you're saying, in the first place, people ate. Were there any scandals associated with the cult, with the group?
None that I can confirm. Yeah. Also, if there was, a lot of these people have passed away. Yeah. So, and there's not lots of records of things. So who knows? I mean, everything's hearsay. My experience of them was just very authentic, and they have amazing structure for communal living, and they were very generous with me.
Well, tell us more. Tell us more about your experience again, and what it took to. Because you said I'm going to come in. I'd like to take pictures. What was their response to that?
Well, I went to them and explained to them that I was at Duke and that I do documentary work and documentary photography, and they have a photo archive that they needed organized. So they invited me to come and stay there and organize their photo archive. And I actually didn't go with the intent of photographing them. Particularly, I wanted to see what happened. So, I mean, sort of very ethnographically, I stay there and learn the songs and learn the recipes and garden with people. And it really wasn't till maybe a week to 10 days that I began taking pictures. I really wanted to see how it went and what was going to happen. And I took these pictures, and I would do these weekly slideshows for them and show them the work and, you know, talk about the historical significance of their own pictures. I mean, so, you know, it was, and they really enjoyed that.
What's your mindset going in? This is obviously something outside of a mainstream, outside of what would be normal for you. What do you tell yourself going in about the people that you're going to meet and be a part of for this time?
Well, we're assuming that my mindset is closed down in some capacity. I mean, they're people of faith. What is religion, right? It's a bunch of stories trying to decipher the unknown. This is a group of people trying to decipher the unknown like any group, mainstream or fringe. I mean, my approach, we can look at just the way that I use equipment. I don't use a telephoto lens. I don't use a zoom lens. I use a fixed lens, which means that the proximity of my subjects to me is what's reflected in the photographs. And that means that I'm essentially in conversation distance when you see these pictures, that I am in relationship to them. And this is really key. And I think that that's what the photographs are about. And that's the only real way to get at their stories, is to know their history, to know their faith, and then to be able to capture glimpses of that by spending time and being in that conversation distance.
Tell us about the banquet meals, because those are still going on, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Those are the sacred space. And so I could never photograph at a banquet meal. And in fact, that actually made it really challenging, because meals last from about 6 to 8 hours a day. So I had very few hours to actually shoot.
So, is there a single meal that lasts six
no.
to 8 hours?
Or? So breakfast is like an hour and a half, and then lunch is like 2 to 2.5 hours, and then dinner is just like open season. It could just go on forever. And you listen to Father's words at every meal. And actually, I have some of that represented in the photos. There's one photo of the reel-to-reel tapes, because they have every form of technology that they captured his words on, because historically he spoke at the banquets. And so they're keeping his presence alive in hearing him. And I think that's also what the photos are about, is, you know, how they're embodying his presence. And I think you can see that in their material culture, in their landscape, in the way they dress, and I think most significantly in their daily activities and in their chores. I mean, because a lot of the photos are about those small moments in life where, but for them, because he is still alive, he didn't die. I mean, to the outside world, right, he died in 1965. But in their words, he lay his body down in 1965, and he's still there.
There's still a place for him at the table.
Oh, yeah, there's still a place for him, and he's served, and you talk to him in the present tense, and you ask for his blessing before you eat food. And no, he's very much alive for them. And so I was just hoping to try to begin to depict what that kind of enduring faith is and also what that kind of embodiment is, you know, to, I mean, documenting faith is a really big challenge.
You have a photograph and it's on our website as well. That's a part of your exhibit at the Carrick in Durham, but it's a photograph of what appears to be a notebook with the sayings of Father Divine.
Yeah, on the perfect picture. So what followers would do is they would pick passages that spoke to them or, you know, that were remarkable in some capacity, and they would create their own notebooks of their favorite passages. And so that's one of the followers' notebooks. And I was really interested because he talks about the divine photographer and the role of photography. So I kind of went in looking around for these quotes, and it was a lot of fun. But he has this concept of the perfect picture, which is if you harmonize, you equalize, and you focus, you can conjure up a perfect picture.
Also very common to many religious traditions, those ideas. Another photograph here, maybe you can describe this. It's of the back of a woman with no shoes, and she's holding a clock.
Right. So she's wearing no shoes because she just went swimming. They do have shoes in the International Peace Mission movement.
All right.
So that is an evangelical bathing suit. And Father Divine said that they should be covered in a certain way when they swam. And so we had been swimming in the pool on the estate, and I took that picture afterwards. And it's 5:45 in that clock because Mother Divine's going to be ringing the bell for 6 o'clock. And when you're in the pool, you're not wearing a watch, so you bring the clock to the pool to know when to get out to change to be ready for the banquet dinner.
I mean, it's interesting, and I wonder what your feeling is afterwards, because it's easy enough to call something like this a cult. A man claims to be God. He has tens of thousands of followers, believes in peace, believes in racial integration, focusing your mind on good things. I happen to practice a faith whose founder died on Friday and then rose from the dead on Sunday, turns out, and he is still among us and shows up every Sunday in a piece of bread. So you could look at that as kind of crazy, but then many people in our listening audience believe that. So what was your take on this? You know, who's a cult and who's not, and sort of how we view religions like this?
I think if you give a few thousand years to anybody, it's, you know, going to become institutionalized if we remember. But don't quote me on that now that I've said it on the radio.
Talk about crazy religions. Credit default swaps. There's this religion called Wall Street.
You're talking about Wall
They believe in the God of
God.
The gross domestic product.
So
they
relevant.
Have many
this
religious
so relevant,
manifestations.
Frank. So relevant.
New
Thank
York
you.
Stock Exchange. I think they call it the Nikkei in Japan.
I'm so glad you
Do you know what they call it
up.
In London? What? The footsie.
Tell
Kinky,
me.
Isn't it? Tell they call it the footsie.
You know, it's I'm so just saying. Good. It's so good you bring this up because it'll give us something to talk about after the show. Because what were we going to talk about? We can now talk about your religious and anarcho-Marxist beliefs on the Wall Street. I think this is a great like post-show coffee discussion, but I just wanted to say one more thing about my body of work in relationship to your question
about
stereotypes
about
and
whose
cults.
Religions and what are cults
right,
and
yes.
beliefs and things that don't
right.
exist. Yes, go ahead.
Go for it. Right. No. All right. So, so I think photographically, you know, they have been also depicted as a cult. I mean, it's not just like Hearst and the newspapers and hearsay and just general societal thing. And they've been sensationalized. And I think one way that they could have been depicted now in the trend in photography is with a lot of irony, like, oh, look at them in their ways. And I am completely uninterested in irony. In fact, I'm interested in the nuance. And also, and I think with these photos, can attempt to do is there is a sense of the inner landscape and the kind of inner landscape that comes about in the moments between moments. So far from being ironic or sensational, I think they're quite quiet and reverent and hoping to catch just some moments and glimpses of faith.
I think it's wonderful. What you did is great. The way you did it is great. And it certainly shines a light on the willingness of all of us to believe in the impossible and in things that don't exist. So I think the way you've portrayed this is fantastic. Kristen Bedford, photographer, her most recent project, The Presence of Father Divine, which you can see March 18th through the 30th at the Carrick Modern Art Museum in Durham. Kristen, thanks so much for being
thanks
on the program.
Thanks so much.
Just ahead, the hidden story behind the murder of jazz musician Lee Morgan. Stay tuned.